everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today I'm talking with Mark I. Lurie about his biography of the 20th century literary critic and translator Louis Galantier, entitled Galantier, The Lost Generation's Forgotten Man. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark. My pleasure.
Well, it's our pleasure to have you. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Well, I'm 74 years old. And people ask me whether this is what my next book is going to be, which I find a bit ironic. I actually didn't intend to write this book. I was told by my sister about a distant relative we had who may have been influential in literature or politics. What did I know about him? It turns out that I had met his sister, Ida, but I knew nothing about him, including his existence. So I was given the name by my sister. And I said, I'll see what I can find out. And then 5 years passed without my doing anything. But I went to an online search engine and entered his name and found that his papers were at Columbia University, the Butler Rare Books and Manuscripts Library. I called there, and they were very generous with their time and assistance. They arranged for me to come, and when I arrived, there were 30 or 35 boxes of papers, thousands of pages, all laid out and ready for me. I had come prepared not to read them there. I came with a camera and photographed the pages and spent probably the next 6 or 8 months going through them and seeing what they had to say, still just doing research for the pleasure of learning about a relative with no intention of writing a book. But 2 years down the pike, having visited the University of Pennsylvania and Princeton and the JFK Library, I found that there was the makings of a book. And so I set about writing one. And I must say, I enjoyed the research much more than the writing.
I think there are quite a few people who can definitely relate to that sentiment. Right. So... It was interesting that how reading this book and learning about Louis Galantier was interesting on two levels. One was, you know, who he was and this really remarkable life that he led as a author and friend of authors. But also it was, as you explain, you infer with the end of the book when you quote his New York Times obituary that it's a life that required a little bit of detective work to get past some of the misrepresentations that he himself made about it. For example, he presented himself as being the son of these of a French family, and as you explained that his background is actually very different.
Yes. He presented himself as the son of a French father, a Swiss mother, a man who was schooled in the classics, who wrote margins in the text of Greek and German works, and who was an intellectual soulmate. In fact, his parents escaped the pogroms of Latvia in 1888, took a boat ride to the United States, settled in Chicago. His father was a failed tobacconist, and after the peddler trade, the tobacconist was the second most common trade because it was quite easy to enter. The man spoke Yiddish. If he spoke English, it was with a thick Yiddish accent. He was very old world. And in fact, Louis and his father were alienated at a very fairly young age. Louis, one fortunate part of Louis's early life was that they were in Chicago where the settlement house schools were available to foster and encourage students. They could progress as quickly as their talents allowed. And Louis, at a very young age, in his early teen years, had mastered French and literature. He could analyze and discuss many topics, and his teachers thought that this was somebody who was going to have an intellectual impact in America, and they predicted that he would be he would go on to college and be a name. But shall I continue?
Please do. Go right ahead.
Well, his this all ended with the failure of the Knickerbocker Bank run in 1908. His father was one of four brothers. The other three were in a printer bindery business, so it did quite well, but his father's business was quite poor, and they lived in tenements for his first 13 years. But with the Knickerbocker Bank failure, all businesses contracted. The printing bindery business could support only one of the three brothers. The other two and Joseph Galantier, Lewis's father, moved out to Los Angeles, which was then actually advertising itself as a cure for tuberculosis. And it was in Los Angeles, his uncles made clear to him that they weren't going to support the family. They expected Lewis to make his contribution as well. So he didn't complete grade school. He went to work as a clerk for the Santa Fe Railroad, but continued his self-education outside of the classroom.
That theme of runs through his early life. It wasn't so much that he didn't have the ability; it was that he didn't have the opportunity. And you could tell recurs throughout the book, which is the degree to which, as America is becoming more about credentials and education, that he felt that keenly. I was thinking about that as far early as his entry into that Los Angeles librarian training program, and how he gave himself a year in college that he actually had never had, and how he completed this training program successfully, and that gave him legitimate credentials. But it kind of points to this thing that issue that crops up time and again, which is where he doesn't have that college education, but he's able, in a sense, to get away with it still.
Oh, yes. In two ways. Number one, he never did speak about what you're referring to is that the Los Angeles public library system offered a course in how to become a librarian. And he took the entrance exam in 1914 and passed it. And he was the only man or boy in a class of 14. Just as an example of the kinds of questions he was asked, one of the questions is, the first one is, make an outline of English literature from the time of Chaucer, giving the periods with approximate dates and the principal writers in each. and I could go on, the scope of the knowledge required, as well as the depth, was jaw dropping. He passed, and he was admitted. Now he never said that he went to the librarian school, because I think he was embarrassed by that. But there is no doubt that that experience is what he based, or what gave him, the confidence to review books. And that is what he did after his graduation. He moved back to Chicago and went to work as a salesman for Croke's Bookstore in Chicago. And this was the time of the Chicago Renaissance, where Chicago and New York were vying for preeminence in America, the new brand of American literature. That's where Sherwood Anderson wrote his book Winesburg, Ohio, which really set off the naturalist trade. And then there was Carl Sandburg and Ben Hecht, Ring Lardner, Theodore Dreiser, they all gathered at Croke's Bookstore, where Lewis was a salesman, and he started writing literary criticism and book reviews for the newspapers in the era and the Dial, which was a very prestigious literary review at the time.
You described it as the most prestigious literary review at the time, too.
Correct. That's right. So it was, and he was 21 years old and doing this. He formed a very fast friendship with Sherwood Anderson, the one that lasted their lifetime. And it was Sherwood, in fact, I'm going to jump ahead a bit, but Lewis mentored Hemingway during Hemingway's first year in Paris, and it was Sherwood Anderson who put the two of them together. At the in Chicago, Lewis Sherwood was something of a mentor to Hemingway, and he sent him off. Hemingway wanted to go back to Italy to relive his war experiences with his bride Hadley, but Sherwood said, "No, not Italy. Go to Paris. That's where it's happening." And he did.
What was it that brought Lewis himself to Paris, though? How did he go from Chicago to Paris in just a few short years?
One of the truly startling things is they say that fortune favors the prepared mind, but Lewis certainly had extraordinary fortune. He was a librarian. He was working for the San Diego Library, and they lent him out to the army. This is World War I. To essentially run a bookmobile. He did it effectively, and the Army hired him to run their library services nationwide. When the war ended and the soldiers were coming home, the Army established a school outside of Chicago to teach soldiers how to become librarians. And one of the guest speakers at that was a fellow named Frederick Paul Capel, who was the dean of had been the dean of Columbia College. He had been tapped to head the International Chamber of Commerce, the U.S. legation, in Paris after the war. And of course, their interest there was of the Chamber of Commerce was to get U.S. war loans repaid and to get contractors their fair share of the reconstruction. And he was a guest speaker at Lewis's library school. And when he met Lewis, he thought this guy would be excellent as my secretary, my executive secretary. He speaks French. He knows something about how to run an organization. He was running the school. So he said to Lewis, "How would you like to go to France?" And Lewis said, "Yes." And so they did in late 1920, December 1920. They sailed to France.
So these interactions with the people like, say, Hemingway, Gertrude Stein, so forth, that he has in Paris, was this an offshoot of his work for the International Chamber of Congress, Commerce, or was he doing this in his spare time?
He was doing this in his spare time. Although one of the people he befriended in Chicago was another book reviewer named Burton Rasko. Burton also has been neglected by history unjustifiably. I thought he was very creative and a very smart fellow. Burton at the time was literary editor for the New York Tribune. And Lewis wanted to earn a little bit of money, so he suggested to Burton, why don't I write a weekly column from Paris talking about what's going on? Burton was reluctant. At first he said no, but after two or three letters he said, "Send me a column, we'll see how it works." It worked very well. And Burton, after that, was very enthusiastic. The 140 columns later, Lewis was established as the American voice in Paris. And it was in that context that he met and was exposed to all of the writers who came to Paris. I'm going to ask your indulgence here. Well, I guess I can't find it. The letter that Sherwood Anderson gave to Hemingway to give to Lewis is charming. talks about this young man, Hemingway, who wants to be an author. Hemingway had been turned down by everybody. Every article he sent into the Saturday Evening Post had been rejected. I'm sure the Saturday Evening Post was kicking itself 3 years later when The Sun Also Rises came out to national acclaim. But he was very unsure of himself and spent a lot of time at the Dome, that restaurant in Paris, speaking to other writers, but really not getting traction. And he was very frustrated and possibly depressed at that time.
You described the some of the escapades of Galantir with Hemingway, and that sense of insecurity is definitely there, such as that boxing match that you open the book with, where Hemingway challenges Galantir to spar, and you describe how Galantir is not quite in Hemingway's doesn't have Hemingway's need to demonstrate his masculinity, but he steps up and does it anyway. It's rather a humorous tale.
Well, Hemingway towered. This is what happened. Lewis took Hemingway, Ernest, and Hadley out to dinner, and Ernest talked about boxing, which was a great avocation of his. He had been involved in a demonstration match on the boat over, and had soundly beaten his adversary. Lewis had a little bit of boxing experience at a training camp in the Army out west, and he talked about that, and he was very good with voices, imitating people, and he imitated this boxer quite well. And Hadley was charmed, and the more Hadley was charmed, the more, provoked Ernest was. And Ernest said to Lewis, "I happen to have two pair of boxing gloves back at my room. Why don't we do a little sparring? Now, what kind of person carries around two pairs of boxing gloves?" But Lewis, probably not want to appear the coward, or maybe not wanting to disappoint Sherwood Anderson, said yes. And they put on the gloves. Now, Lewis was 5'5" and 137 pounds, and Hemingway was over 6 feet and very muscular. And they stepped into an area, and Hadley pretended she was ringing a bell, and they parried, and they skipped and touched gloves and all. Nobody landed a real hit. And 3 minutes went by, and Hadley sounded another bell. I'm sure Lewis was relieved. And he stepped to the side of the room, and he took off a glove, and he removed his glasses, and he turned toward Hemingway just as Hemingway was approaching, and sucker punched Lewis in the face. And that might have ended things, but I guess Lewis wanted to show that he was the kind of guy who could take it. And Hemingway certainly was the kind of guy who wasn't going to burn a bridge before he had crossed it. So they made amends, and in fact, Lewis was instrumental in finding the Hemingway's a place to live, and introducing him to Ezra Pound and others. And Ezra Pound was very influential, I think most influential in Hemingway's style of writing, which was completely different from Lewis's. There is one tale that's told by Hemingway of how when he first met Ezra Pound, he was put off. He thought he was too out there, too avant-garde, too much of a pretender. And he wrote a rather scathing satire of Pound, which he was going to offer for publication. And Lewis said to him, "I wouldn't quite do that, because the magazine you're going to offer this to, he works for them for free. He serves as their advisor. They aren't going to publish it. And you're going to have a city full of enemies if you try to do this." So Ernest tore it up and was very glad he did. He spoke of it later. And it was Pound probably who had the greatest influence, because He was the one who insisted that that Hemingway use spare prose, use no word that doesn't convey something, is what Pound told Hemingway. It was advice that Hemingway heeded, and you can see the change in his writing from that time on. It was much more disciplined, and what he left out was as important as what he kept in.
You describe, though, in your book that what Galanteer did was not just befriend writers or provide them with advice or even just review their books, but he also was engaged in this very interesting work involving translation. For example, he helped Sherwood Anderson translate one of his books early in his stay in Paris. I was wondering if you could explain what led him into translation work and what it was that he did, what sort of books did he translate, and how did he, what did he bring to the translation effort?
What he brought was an English vocabulary and knowledge of how to use it. He never translated from English to French. His French was not all that good. Despite his fiction of having spent years in France, he did not. But he could understand a concept expressed in French and translate it into English so that it was better than the original French was. And there are examples that I provide in my book where I give the French, I give a strict French translation, and I give Lewis's translation. And you can see how his images are more evocative than the literal French translation into English. All of his translations were into English. He was adept at it and did it quickly. And at several times in his life, when that was the only employment he had, and translators were paid a small a pittance because they were thought to be scriveners. Volume was important, and he grew expert at it. He did a good job.
It was during this period that he also met and married his first wife, Dorothy. I was wondering if you could explain a bit about their relationship and how it changed as his time in France came to an end.
Oh, well, Dorothy was his first infatuation and may have been his first sexual experience. He was besotted, and Dorothy was the first in a line of women who were manic depressives, whom he was romantically involved with. And she was an amazing narcissist. Something that Ernest took exception to, probably because he lived so closely to it himself. But she saw Lewis as a rising star, and she liked the limelight that came with that. That changed. Well, first of all, Dorothy became a bone of contention between the Hemingways and Lewis. Neither Hadley nor Ernest particularly liked Dorothy. They found her selfish and needy and clingy and untruthful. And when Dorothy thought that Lewis had spoken, well, that he had been responsible for the falling out between them, Lewis actually never fell out with Hemingway. The two of them remained friends, but the couples fell out. And Lewis and Dorothy sent a letter to Hadley attributing it to Lewis and what she called his cowardice, his causing this perturbation, but not owning up to it. And Ernest got the letter and wrote a scathing letter to Dorothy in which, he eviscerated her. Now, the sad part about this, it probably rolled off Dorothy's shoulders, but Dorothy's mother was an a woman who would have appeared in a Hemingway novel. She had character, perseverance, dignity, she was gentle, she was kind, and she was dying of tuberculosis through all of it. And she persevered despite that. And I think that she was a model for what Ernest valued in life and in his novels. She returned to the United States to die. And Ernest wrote Dorothy a condolence note, which was very sweet, which Dorothy construed as a mending of the relationship, which it was not, because Ernest continued to, in his correspondence to others, to say, I'm quoting, what a copper-plated bitch Dorothy was. When Lewis eventually lost his job at the International Chamber of Commerce because they decided they wanted an economist, a degreed economist, and Lewis was not. So he went back to New York with Dorothy, thinking that he would be able to find a job and find work on the basis of the credential he had established as with his Paris newsletter criticisms. He couldn't get a job. He finally landed one with Condé Nast, but it wasn't a writing job. Condé Nast wanted him to do a business assessment, an assessment of his magazines, which Lewis did. And then when that job ended, he was unemployed, and he set about writing his translations, but the limelight was lost. The promise of fame, the implicit promise of fame that Lewis had offered to Dorothy disappeared. And Dorothy got on a boat and went back to Paris, where she decided she had danced in the chorus in New York before going to New York, before going to Paris. I think she was 16 at the time. Now she was, I think, in her mid-20s, late 20s, and she had a hunch that if she could have a one-person show that she would choreograph and perform, she might become the equivalent of a Josephine Baker for another crowd. So she went back to Paris, had an affair with a sculptor, a Palm Beach sculptor, who financed her one-person show, created playbills, and I found Gertrude Stein's copy of the playbill among her papers at the JFK Library, and had her show, which was not greeted well. The critics, I'm afraid I don't have my book open to it now, but the French critics especially were a little cruel.
It was Andre Levinson's one the criticism I liked the most. He wrote that Dorothy had, quote, sought in vain to relieve her entire lack of ability by a touch of suggestiveness. And then, as you write, he advised that in the future she confine her performances to private salons.
Yes. Ooh, isn't that savage? Lewis, back in New York, he was working on a book, the only book of a non-political nature he ever produced, which was a satire called France is Full of Frenchmen. He was working on that and doing his translations, and was hit with a bout of appendicitis, which sidelined him and further cut his income. And as he was recuperating, he had an affair with Iris Berry. Some people may know that name. She was the first director of MoMA's film library. And it was, they knew it was only going to be an interlude because Iris was married and Lewis was married, and Iris was going to go back to London. And I only have Iris's side. The book only contains Iris's correspondence with Lewis, but I think they are deftly written and poignant, and they talk about Hollywood. She was a film critic and film analyst, and she talks about Charlie Chaplin, and she was there with the in crowd and Douglas Fairbanks, but also about her children, things that weren't previously known, including that she had two children by Wyndham Lewis, a rather bizarre and intense and nasty painter and author in London, although I think they lived in Paris for a while. And she had two children whom she placed with different families. She decided she was going to attempt motherhood with her older daughter. She tried it, it didn't work, and she placed both of them in I won't say it was an orphanage, but an extended foster home, without revealing to them that they were brother and sister, and then dreaded the consequences that might ensue if they found each other attractive. But that didn't come to pass, fortunately. Iris eventually did return to the United States, where she and Lewis were cordial, and he eventually wrote a nice review for one of her books. She did not stay in the United States during the McCarthy era, because she had had some contact with Soviet sympathizers, and she was hounded out of the country, essentially, and returned to France.
You mentioned that Galantir only wrote the one book that, as you said, was not of a political nature. But during this period in the early 1930s, he does have this collaboration with another very famous name, or soon a man who's going to become famous in the future, which was John Houseman. And what was it that they were working on, and what was the fruit of that collaboration?
Well, Lewis, when he was recovering from his appendectomy, and he thought he would be evicted because he just ran out of money, he got a knock on the door from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. They wanted to hire him because here was a fellow who had been in contact with all of the financial movers and shakers in France. And they needed somebody, not necessarily a banker, but somebody who knew their culture, could speak their language, who knew their sensibilities, and yet could understand something of finance. And the reason they tapped him was that at this time, the French franc was going into hyperinflation. The French budget was out of control. They were spending money in anticipation of getting money from Germany in the form of reparations. Of course, those reparations never happened, and it was a pipe dream probably from the start. The money they eventually did get was American short-term loans from Germany funneled back through to France's reparations. But Lewis and the Federal Reserve officials went back to Paris. By the way, during that trip, they set up at the offices of J.P. Morgan and Company and dealt with the French Central Bank. During that trip, Lewis did arrange to meet with Dorothy Butler, his wife, and asked for a divorce, which she gave him, on the condition that he said he would represent on the divorce certificate that he had abandoned her. Well, the cure for the Federal Reserve Bank thought that the cure for the French economy, or at least the French franc, was to tie it more closely to gold, to stop spending money as if there were going to be reparations. And one other element, which now eludes me, but it worked. The French franc stabilized and, in fact, increased in value and became one of the more reliable currencies during the 1930s.
So So Galantir has this very interesting job. And what I was thinking of as I was reading those passages about how, you know, during the Great Depression, he's still employed by the Federal Reserve Bank. And he has this amazingly secure existence for somebody who is a writer, and how that contrasts with John Houseman, who, as you explained, was not a writer to start out. He was actually a grain merchant who had this enormous enormously troubled fall financially speaking.
Yes, I will describe that. He spoke with a kind of a British accent, which lent him great credibility, and he turned out to be a wonderful salesman. He was working. He got a job for the Continental Grain Company in St. Louis. They taught him what it took to be a grain trader. Well, he, in his first year, did fabulously well. So a private investor came to him and said, "I'll set you up with a business in New York. They call it the Oceanic Grain Corporation. I'll pay you." And now bear in mind, at the time he was, 27 years old. "I'll pay you $275,000 a year and 5% of the profits." Well, he jumped at the chance and created this corporation. Now, Lewis, of course, dealt, when he came back from France, his job was information, gathering information about international trade and sharing it to the extent that was necessary in order to elicit information. And he and Lewis would have lunch together, Houseman and Lewis. Houseman, by the way, won himself an Academy Award a few years later for his, it was four decades later, for his role as Professor Charles Kingsfield in The Paper Chase. You might remember him. Mr. Hot, please stand and explain contract law. Very intimidating presence. Well, he and Lewis would have lunch together, and he felt himself a merchant prince in New York because he was young, he had a fabulous income, and he met and within a month married Zita Johann, who was a leading actress at the time. He went out and rented himself a penthouse apartment, had it completely furnished. It was very nice, and they were the golden couple in New York. Now, John's practice in the grain business was to find a seller to him, find a buyer from him, and finance the difference, always having a fairly safe margin, a profit, between the purchase price and the sale price. And so on October 24th, Black Thursday, when the markets started to implode, he felt comfortable because he knew that he had all of his purchases covered, all of his loans covered, with buyers who had signed contracts. And one by one, the buyers started defaulting because their customers said, "I can't afford it. I can't make these purchases." One after another, so that finally, well, they started post-dating checks. Then they started not answering phones, and then they closed the door. And in early 1930, this Oceanic Trading Company, the Oceanic Grain Company, closed its doors, still owing about $200,000, leaving John worse than penniless because he thought, "This seems like a good deal. I'll borrow $17,000 and invest in the business." So he was $17,000 in debt. He had 2 years to run on a penthouse lease. He had not paid for the furnishings. And in 1930, he would earn not $275,000, but $275. So it was a far come down. And obviously, he defaulted on the lease. He walked away from the furniture. And he thought that maybe he could write. He attempted to do that for 6 months. He always had a notion that he had a talent for it, and 6 months without a word on paper proved that he was wrong. His wife, Zita Johann, suggested that they co-write a play, which they did. And they found a venue for it, which was the Berkshire Playhouse in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, which agreed to put it on, provided that Zita played the lead, which she did. By the way, she took credit as a co-author, but not under her own name, under the name Joan Wolfe. When the opportunity came along for Zita to join a roadshow of Uncle Vanya, she did. She left New York. And that was when John Houseman turned to Lewis, because Lewis had a reputation of having been a literary critic and a translator, and they thought maybe they could write a play, which they did. And it was it was Two and One was the name of it, or it opened in London. It did do badly in London, but it tanked in the U.S. They were given another chance to do another play on Broadway, which ran, I think, for, 120 performances. Here it is. It ran for 120 performances, and Lewis and John each earned $400 for it. So, but Lewis did introduce John to Virgil Thompson, who Lewis had known in Paris. He introduced him at one of Constant Askew's Sunday salons. And Virgil had written the music, and Gertrude Stein had written the libretto for an all-black cast in an opera and drama titled Four Saints in Three Acts. And they were looking for someone who would be a producer, who could handle all of the complexities that might arise, and you never know what's going to arise as a producer, and do it for free. And Lewis told Thompson that Houseman was their man. It was logistically, it was a very tough production to assemble and to carry out. And Houseman did it. He succeeded. And he gained a reputation as someone who was an effective producer. Then he met Orson Welles, and I guess the rest is history. The two of them collaborated in the Mercury Theater, and theirs was the War of the Worlds scare that happened in 1929. But they were successful. They had a falling out shortly after that. But Houseman went on to Hollywood, where he became a very successful producer. Houseman and Lewis would reunite when war broke out. They would reunite at the Office of War Information, where they were both in charge of what was the equivalent of propaganda.
Could you elaborate a bit more upon that period? What was it that led Galanteer to work for the OWI during the Second World War?
Well, he had left the bank to do the translation of Saint-Exupéry's latest novel, which Lewis named Wind, Sand, and Stars, and may have been a bit politicized by that. But when war seemed imminent, I guess Lewis had the calling. He was recruited, and he went willingly. They thought that he knew the French psyche and could broadcast from New York via shortwave generally. Sometimes they would send less urgent broadcasts by tape or wire, magnetic wire, by boat, but they could broadcast by shortwave to France and give them encouragement and let them know that the United States was with them in spirit. If of course, prior to Lend-Lease and then the attack on the Pearl Harbor, not in fact.
So he's involved in this, developing these audio broadcasts, and he doesn't just stay in the United States. He travels around quite a bit, and he undergoes this rather horrific plane accident that you describe in your book. I was wondering if you could elaborate upon how you know, how he overcame that and what he then did afterward.
Sure. It was, he was placed in charge of field operations for overseas operations and in Europe. And his base of operations was to be London. So he set out on October 3rd, 1942, aboard one of those large flying boats. You've probably seen pictures of them. They got four large radial engines, and the hull is meant to it's a water hull, large pontoons on the wings. The name of the boat was the Excalibur. It couldn't make it from New York to London in a single flight, so they flew up to Nova Scotia to Botwood Harbor, and they landed there as an intermediate fueling stop at sunset, and everybody got off the plane and had dinner. And it was a remote harbor, and there were no lights, both for security reasons and because, well, this was Botwood. There wasn't much to light up, and the air was clear and cold. And everybody after dinner got into their seats in the plane, and if you like, I'll read you a short section from the book, which actually describes this accident.
Please do.
The fuselage door was shut tight, and Excalibur lumbered back into the harbor for takeoff. The pilot ran through the checkoff list and then the takeoff checklist, and then slowly pushed the throttle levers forward to full power. The throbbing of the Excalibur's four radial engines filled the cabin as the aircraft gathered speed, its hull splashing along the water's surface and then lifting off. But once airborne, the plane transmitted the shuddering vibrations that indicated an imminent stall. The pilot lowered the nose to trade altitude for airspeed, and when the aircraft was just above the surface, pulled back on the wheel. The Excalibur rose, but once again signaled her intention to stall. Struggling to remain airborne, the pilot entered into a series of porpoising arcs and dives until the airport slammed nose first into the icy water, its engines roaring. Upon impact, the fuselage broke away at the tail, and the cabin immediately flooded. Lewis, struck unconscious, was submerged, and when the divers got to him, his lungs were water-filled and he wasn't breathing. His was one of 26 cold bodies removed from the aircraft and taken to the hospital.
And he survived that.
He survived. There's apparently an anatomical reaction to cold water called the mammalian diving reflex. They got salt water out of his lungs. They revived him and they brought him back to life. Lord knows how long he was submerged. It had to have been minutes, but he made it back. And after about a week or 10 days of recovery, returned to New York. It was amazing. He got a letter from a friend. He got lots of letters of concern and praise. And he got one letter from a friend, Burton Rasko, who again was a literary editor. And it says, while you are taking a forced rest, maybe you'd like to tackle a job. A publisher asked me if I could condense the decline and fall of the Roman Empire into a single volume of about 400 pages.
So it speaks to just how renowned he was as a editor and translator by that point, doesn't it?
Yes, he was well known.
Yes,
it's amazing how quickly his reputation faded because the name Galantir was well known in the 30s and 40s.
Well, your book seems to suggest why that is, because he is involved with the OWI during the war. And as you explain, after the war, he doesn't really go back to the literary world. He instead transitions into working for Radio Free Europe. I was wondering if you could perhaps explain a bit what he was doing with Radio Free Europe and how he was how he ends up playing this role in terms of the Hungarian Revolution in 1956.
Yes. Actually, he did get back to some writing. We can get back to that if you'd like. Namely, with Flight to Arras with Saint-Exupéry and with Antigone. But what happened was that he was writing for the Council on Foreign Relations. They have a magazine called Foreign Affairs. And he probably applied the political perspectives and judgments he acquired while with the OWI, the Office of War Information, to articles that he submitted to Foreign Affairs. One article titled America Today, A Freehand Sketch, was probably the best piece of writing he did in his life. And he received letters of praise from Eugene Rostow, who became the dean of Yale Law School, from Alfred Knopf and other notables. And shortly after that article appeared, the North Koreans invaded South Korea. And at that time, at that very same time, a committee, an anti-communist committee, the Free Europe Committee, was created here in the United States by Alan Dulles and Frank Altschul and others to tell the American story. And Lewis volunteered. So I'll do whatever I can to help. Well, I made him counsel to Radio Free Europe and had him write the handbook. The handbook is astounding in length and specificity. It's 60 pages long. But he and it set forth the general policies. Lewis then was in charge of policy, and he would write what were called guidances, which have taken on a bad name recently. But the people in the Radio Free Europe stations, it was based in Munich, but there was a Radio Hungary, a Radio Czechoslovakia, Radio Poland. They weren't given scripts to simply rebroadcast. They were given guidelines, hence the guidances, to matters that they could discuss. And the objective was to accurately report the news, the mismanagement that was going on in the communist bloc countries. After the briefly, what happened was that there was a divergence between the in the 1952 and 1956 political campaigns, presidential campaigns between Eisenhower and Stevenson. Both candidates were saying, if any of the Eastern Bloc countries, if the peoples of any of the Eastern Bloc countries organize an armed revolt, we will be with them. And Lewis kind of understood that that wasn't going to happen because the Soviets had exploded their first nuclear weapon. We weren't going to expend blood and treasure in the Eastern Bloc countries. But that was the political – bear in mind that this was the era of McCarthy. And so people were trying to get to the right in their political postures. I forget the exact date, but three things changed in the Soviet Union. Stalin died. Khrushchev denounced him in his what was called a secret speech, which was soon leaked and wasn't so secret. There was a deal made with Marshal Tito in Yugoslavia, which said, we won't really interfere with your country's business, provided you stand by us in international affairs. And so there was a thought that there might be an opportunity for the West to make better encroachments.
What I was thinking in that passage as I was reading it was how it seemed like Galantir better understood the power of words than these people who were dealing with. That he was dealing with superiors and others who were talking about this rhetoric of, you know, we're going to stand by you, we encourage you to rise up. And Galantir knew, you know, perhaps because of his own experience as an author and translator, that, you know, words can have an effect that is far greater than you intend necessarily for them to have.
Well, yes, but it was also the ideas behind the words that were so pernicious. It was the difference between liberation, which was what Eisenhower and Stevenson were advocating, and containment. There were two factions, essentially, that developed at Radio Free Europe. We had the people with the boots on the ground, kind of, which was Paul Hensey and Griffith. I have a momentary mental block in his first name, but they were on the ground. William Griffith, they were on the ground in Europe, and they knew what was going on, and they knew that the U.S. wasn't going to be sending any kind of military support there, and Lewis knew it too. On the other hand, we had these armchair warriors at Radio Free Europe who had no experience in this kind of thing. They were political appointees, and they were bellicose as could be. There's a term now for it. It's not armchair warriors, but they were holding sway. And Griffith, Hensey, and Lewis continually had to stop what was going on. Well, what happened was that the Hungarian desk was very weak. Its personnel the staffing had to be remade. Everybody who was there saw the need. And Lewis proposed to a fellow named Shepherdson, who was then head of the Free Europe Committee, that he undertake that rehabilitation. And Shepherdson cut him out of the loop. Not only didn't he give him that opportunity, but he sidelined him to secondary policy issues. And so when the Hungarian Revolution arose, the people took up arms, Radio Free Europe ignored Lewis's guidances that they be very circumspect and not advocate armed resistance because the U.S. was not going to be coming to their aid. And Radio Free Europe in Hungary lost its way. They had a fictitious general who had airtime who said, this is how you organize, this is how you arm, this is how you get the radios, this is how you resist. And they said, and hold out until the United Nations issues a resolution backing you. Well, the Soviet Union had veto power over the General Assembly. That was never going to happen, but the people in Hungary were misled, with the result that there were tens of thousands of lives unnecessarily lost. And Lewis was right. It was a Pyrrhic political victory for Lewis, but it made very little difference to the people of Hungary or to the people in Radio Free Europe, who knew what the right thing to do was.
He, as you describe, Galantir stays with Radio Free Europe until the early 1960s, and then he leaves and assumes this very prestigious position as the president of PEN America. I was wondering if you could briefly describe what he does in that role and how it reflects in many respects a continuation of all that he's been doing over the course of his career.
Sure. When Lewis joined Radio Free Europe, he signed contracts as well with the CIA and the State Department as a consultant. So he essentially had four masters. He had the Free Europe Committee, Radio Free Europe, the CIA, and the State Department. So he was well connected. The problem that PEN America was facing was that the United States was not issuing visas to authors, to anybody who advocated communism. Well, there had never been an international Penn Congress in the United States. And Lewis wanted to have the first, and others did too. The Ford Foundation made a big contribution. So they elected Lewis president of Penn America, and Lewis and Arthur Miller met with Pablo Neruda. Now, if there was ever an emblem of a communist power writer, it was Pablo Neruda. He had a worldwide following. His poetry was known and respected worldwide, but he was a staunch communist. And they met with Pablo in Europe. The particular site eludes me right now. And it was at an international congress of Penn at that site. Arthur Miller was elected president of International Penn. He had protested against the Vietnam War. He had refused to attend a bill signing by Johnson, creating the National Humanities Foundation, or it was one of the first federal agencies advocating for the arts and funding the arts. And he thought he was seen as being a fair person between East and West, or between communist and American and the West. And he was elected president over Pablo Neruda. By the way, the CIA had, Pablo Neruda had been a candidate for the international presidency the year before, and the CIA arranged for him not to be elected. He of course did not know this, but Arthur Miller, Lewis persuaded Pablo Neruda to come to the United States because his presence would allow other communist poets and authors, people who wouldn't want to have the stigma of having gone to the United States, to attend. Neruda said, there's no good way I'm going to get a visa. No, I've tried many times, and I don't want to go through humiliation again. And Lewis promised that this time, if he tried, he would succeed. The conference was to take place in June, and as of May 1966, Lewis had not gotten visas for most of the communist writers, especially the South American writers. And it was going to be a debacle. This was something that the State Department finally realized. How would it look as if this bastion of freedom, the United States, and this organization, Penn, which stood for freedom of expression worldwide and the protection of authors, denied access to authors because of their political views? So in May, they opened the gates, and Pablo Neruda and all of the other South American authors of consequence, except the author from Cuba, who was not allowed by Castro to attend, came, and it was the golden opportunity. It gave prominence to the Latin American writers, gave them worldwide exposures, which they've enjoyed ever since.
I like the page that you have in your book. It's on page 201, where it's from the Saturday Review, and it has the pictures of foreign delegates to the International Penn Conference, and the largest one is Pablo Neruda. It's almost a statement of triumph, of Galantier's triumph, of having made this possible.
Yes, and Neruda was certainly the largest draw. He gave a Friday night reading at the YMCA in New York. Every room was filled and overflowing onto the street. And Lewis had a dinner cruise one night where all of the participants could come. And everybody was crowded around Pablo Neruda and Arthur Miller's wife, by the way, who was a photographer and quite stunning, plus an extraordinarily competent photographer, crowded around them. So the ship was constantly listing wherever they walked.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
I'm actually working on my profession, which is as an arbitrator. This was my one-off book because it was a relative. And as an arbitrator, right now my two biggest cases are where there's no right to strike and the union and management can't agree on the terms of employment. So they bring me in to look at what the factors are, and I recommend what those terms of employment should be. It sounds simple in principle, but it gets very complicated and emotional in fact.
Mm-hmm. Well, for a one-off book, I think it was an excellent effort. Thank you very much for taking some time out of your busy schedule to speak with us, Mark, and I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much. Bye.